You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Oh, I said sunny, didn't I? It's not sunny out there. I'm hoping it'll be a little sunshine. But right now, it's a white sky.
White sky, which has been the case since early November. However,
no, we had some sunny days. And then yesterday, we had rain.
Weren't those sunny days great? They were so nice. We hit 60 degrees 3 days ago, and people were running outside with joy. I wouldn't call it bright and beautiful, although rather pretty out there. These are clouds, not fog at the moment. The Sacramento weather station, they're reporting fog, and we have seen certainly plenty of that in our area. It is overcast. We actually got a tenth of an inch of rain last night, which is our first rain in, I think, 3 full weeks. We have had a very, very firmly positioned ridge blocking everything that was coming in. That is breaking down a bit. I was looking to see overnight how much rain they got in other parts of the state. And up in the northern part, northwestern part, they're half an inch in Shelter Cove. So, not a lot of rainfall. Those areas typically get a lot more than that. But it was an actual storm actually breaking through the ridge, and it's breaking down a bit. So we're going to see a change in the weather anyway, not one dreary day after another with little bits of sunshine in the mid to late afternoon, but actually periods of sun and clouds and all that kind of stuff. Today, which is January 28th, we're recording the show for broadcast on January 29th, 2026. It's going to go to a high of 57 degrees with areas of fog and partly sunny in the late afternoon. We do expect dense fog again tonight. 39 degrees will be the low, and driving will be a bit hairy. The National Weather Service has many pointers on how to drive safely in the fog if you need them. Thursday, the high will be 57 degrees and partly sunny. Thursday night, mostly cloudy, 41 degrees. Friday, 59 degrees, mostly cloudy. Friday night, 43 degrees, mostly cloudy. No rain coming out of these for us, but some in the areas around us. Seems to be the pattern this year. Saturday, 59 degrees and mostly cloudy. Saturday night, 44 degrees and mostly cloudy. Sunday, 58 degrees and cloudy. Monday, mostly sunny. Monday, mostly sunny with a high near 60. We've barely gotten to 60 at all in the last couple of weeks. We did a couple of days ago. This will be a nice change. Monday night, partly cloudy, low around 42. And Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 60. On our property 2 mornings ago, we did have substantial frost because the clouds cleared out middle of the night. The heat was lost to the sky, and we saw quite a bit of frost out here, and we did record a low of about 33 degrees on our farm. So we've had this year probably 7 or 8 frosty mornings, and none of them on our property have gotten below 32 that I can tell. And so we haven't had what you might call a killing frost by our standards, but we have had visible frost. And we've had continued cold temperatures affecting subtropical plants in many cases. Looks like finally a break in the weather with this stationary ridge sort of falling apart. The next storms that are coming through are mostly going north of us, but at least they're getting through. So there is a change in the weather coming up within the next few days. I will note that it's officially spring here in the Sacramento Valley because the bee boxes have been dropped in the almond orchards. So what I mean by that is the companies that provide bee pollination services for the almond growers always in the last week of January are out dropping their boxes of bees at the edges of the orchards. Well, that happened this last weekend. They're out there. They have the little food things on them because there's no almond blossoms out yet, but they're ready. And the fruit trees and nut trees are beginning to push in some cases.
Well, they've got little buds on them. I haven't seen any flowers yet.
Well, this is where I'm getting to. One of my plums, I'm already seeing bud color on it, meaning that the buds have pushed out from the sheath that holds them in, and they're ready to open in the next few days. An apple that I have, it's a variety I've mentioned a number of times because of how fascinatingly weird it is in this area. Anna, A-N-N-A, you can call
apple
it.
Apple Annie?
Anna, if you prefer. Anna. It only needs 200 chilling hours.
And
it got those back in November. It got what it needed. We hit 60 degrees a couple of afternoons ago, and it's pushing out flower buds already. This variety flowers with the almonds in this area. For those of you who know the area, almonds here flower in the month of February. Apples generally flower in the month of March or even into late March, early April. This one is a whole month ahead of all the others. It does this every single year. This is the earliest I've ever seen it pushing out flower buds. So fruit trees have had their chilling hours. All we need is days in the 60s and they'll be pushing out, and we're getting there. We have had 1,118 chilling hours to date, and it's not even February yet. Fruit trees have definitely gotten what they need, and some of them have gotten the trigger to start the process of growing, flowering, whatever.
Don, that apple that blooms a month before all the other apples, mm-hmm. Does it also set its fruit and get ripe a month before the other apples?
It sets fruit very quickly. It sets very heavy crops for me. It's been high, great performer for me. Anna apple is one I got by accident, and that took me a long time to even figure out what it was. But yes, they ripen in July. And that's, there are apples that ripen in July. It's one of them. And it's good. It's an acceptably tasty apple. It's not the best apple you've ever had, but it's productive. It doesn't get fire blight because it blooms so early, and it doesn't need a pollinizer because it fruits without any other apple blooming nearby. So I've mentioned this one before. I don't want to create some huge demand for this because you're not going to find it in nurseries all over the place. But it's worth knowing about this one, that it sets reasonably well, even with only 200 plus chilling hours. And we get way more than that in this area. And it's a good apple. So if you're looking for one and you're in a low chill area, consider, see if your local nursery has it. It's a very pretty tree when it's in bloom. And I always take pictures of it because it's so far ahead of all my other fruit trees and it's flowering that it kind of startles me each year. Well, pushing out even early by its standards this year. We have a pretty crucial temperature threshold, 60 degrees. And I've observed seems to be when we start to stimulate bud development and bloom, if the plants have received their chilling hours. What this means from a retail nursery standpoint and a consumer standpoint, fruit trees are going to be budding out quickly. They came into our nursery in the first week of January. We're in the last week of January, and some of them are already breaking dormancy, which means they have to get in containers. That's how short the fruit tree bare root season is now. So people keep asking, I go out to thus and such a nursery, fill in the blank, all their fruit trees are in pots. They don't even put them out bare root anymore. Yeah, there's a good reason for that.
Climate change.
Yes, indeed. The bare root season requires dormancy. It requires temperatures below 55, 60 degrees during the daytime. And as soon as we get out of those temperatures, they start to push. As we pull them out, we do them bare root still, but not for very long. We pull them out. The roots are already growing. We know we have to start potting them. And it becomes kind of urgent at that point. A lot of nurseries have just looked at that situation, first with roses, which were breaking dormancy as soon as they arrived. Now with many of the fruit trees, especially plums, but some of the others as well. They just pot them as soon as they arrive because it's better use of their time rather than rearranging their entire nursery for a 4-week selling season. It used to be an 8-week selling season. They just pot them as soon as they come in. They do make more money on it, but also keeps the crew busy in the winter. Probably better for the tree in the long run in that regard with respect to, damage to the roots as they're beginning to push out, all that kind of thing. I go back and I look at our sales and how they track week to week. It's about the third week of February. A lot of people start coming in looking for fruit trees. Mm. They're going to be in pots by then. Okay. Yep. And there's no getting around that. I'm going by what the tree needs, not what you'd prefer. And so I guess I would say, I would say if you're looking for bare root, go quick. Okay. Yeah. Cause they're already pushing out.
So Don, I have information about an event.
Yes.
So on February 14th, we have Fair Oaks Horticultural Center, which is a wonderful place, has an open garden. Now, they have a schedule up here on their website of their open garden days, and there's one every month: January 10th, February 14th, March 14th, April 15th, May 9th, June 13th. Once a month. Okay. And the open garden is where you can, well, the garden's open. You can go in, you can look around.
Yep.
They may have people talking or chatting with you or whatever. But there's a special event on the 14th. You remember, perhaps, our talking to you about the Home Orchard book, yep. And their second edition has just come out. Well, they're having a celebrate the launch on the 14th from 9 a.m. till noon at the Fair Oaks Horticultural Center.
Yeah, they're going to have
save the date.
They got a couple programs there that sound really good. Keep fruit trees small with abundant harvest. There we go. Summer pruning, things like that. Fruit tree planting demonstration. Blueberry pruning for optimal growth and fruit production. That's a good one because there's a lot of people new to growing blueberries now since we have so many varieties that have come on the market that are very well adapted. You get 3-4 years in, you're looking at this thing that looks like a giant sprawling rose bush or something, trying to figure out how to prune it. It would be great to go to a pruning actual demonstration. I can talk about it, but it's even better if you can see someone do it. And then this is my favorite, ornamental grass pruning, which, as I said last week, you just tether a goat next to it, and that should take care of the problem. But there are ways to prune ornamental grasses so they don't look as ridiculous as I see in commercial landscapes. They're also honoring the legacy of Chuck Ingalls, farm advisor, Sacramento County, who was a Davis resident for many years. So some folks will be on hand to say a few words about Chuck as well. So that's Saturday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, celebrating the launch of the Home Orchard Second Edition, honoring the legacy of Chuck Ingalls, 9 a.m. to noon at the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center, which is on Fair Oaks Boulevard in Fair Oaks. Easy to find. We always appreciate getting this information. Thank you, Cynthia, for sending this along. Also want to mention there's a couple of new public affairs shows here at KDRT. Public affairs is the term we use for shows like this, where we talk about, you know, things like gardening or news or current events. The Yellow Backyard Bulletin features local news, commentary, music, gossip, true stories from the heart of Yolo County. It broadcasts live from the studios on, patiently looking for the time, Thursday.
There's a schedule tab on the website.
I just had to put on my glasses and scroll down. Thursdays, 5 to 6 p.m. There'll be guests from a wide variety of backgrounds sharing news and views about what's going down here in Yolo County. Guests are generally not scheduled far in advance or invited as current events arise. So that's the Yolo Backyard Bulletin about current events here in Yolo County. And then there's a new one called Hello Davis.
Oh, I love this. This is the one where lots of different organizations are coming on. One week it'll be the Senior Center, another week somebody. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah,
to be
Davis cool. Davis Senior Center will be hosted by Maria Lucchese, Downtown Davis Business Association, hosted by Brett Lee, Davis Phoenix Coalition, Davis Local, My Davis California. These are five local community organizations. They'll rotate as hosts of the program. And that is live Wednesdays, 5 to 6 p.m., produced by our longtime producer, Peter Pasteur. It's Hello Davis, a local, I mean hyper-local show about things going on here and what these organizations do. So they will interview guests connected to their work, share stories, highlight programs, offer a closer look at how they serve Davis. So Yolo Backyard Bulletin, Hello Davis, welcome to the KDRT programming schedule.
Well, let's start off with Catherine from Davis. Mm-hmm. Hi, Don and Lois. My weeping Santa Rosa plum is coming up on 30 years of age, and it has developed these vertical fissures in its trunk. I really love this tree. Is this something to worry about? And if so, what can I do? Thank you so much. And the picture is wonderful.
This is great. Yeah.
It looks just like my plum tree, except it's got vertical cracks in it.
Vertical cracks in the bark of members of the genus Prunus are very common, and they are not necessarily indicative of anything harmful. I always want to zoom in a little closer and see if there's a sign of a bacterial disease, which would be blackened areas, or seeping, signs of sunburn, which would be a rough destruction of the bark and cambium. I don't see any signs of that. These are natural fissures in the crack that occur in plums and cherries and others like this. They aren't an indication of any particular disease. 30 years is a good run for a Santa Rosa plum. Most fruit trees 15 to 25 years is considered their orchard life. 20 to 30 years, in my opinion and observation, more common for home gardeners. And they do start to age, but I don't see anything wrong with this tree. So I don't see presently anything to be concerned about. So no, it's not a disease. It's not a pest. I don't see any sign. I zoomed in as close as I could. No sign of borers or anything like that. So I'm just going to say monitor it. And I'm guessing you get at least a few more years of good production out of this tree. But be aware, 30 years is reaching the lifespan for a stone fruit. That just seems to be, you know, the 25 to 30 years, they start to, something will go wrong. You do get sunburn, you get borers, a branch breaks, things like that start to occur, and they begin to decline in production. But from the picture here, I see nothing to be concerned about so far. So that's good news. However, 30-year-old plum, you should probably head on down to your local nursery sometime in the next year or two, buy yourself a new one. I make this recommendation all the time. Plant it 10, 15 feet away from this one, if you have room, 5 to 10 feet away, if that's all you've got space for, plan on doing some pruning if you do that to keep the trees from crowding each other. Let it grow for a couple of years, and then you can start removing this older, probably by then declining, Weeping Santa Rosa. For those of you who don't know this one, Weeping Santa Rosa is a, I assume it's a spontaneous mutation that occurred a number of years ago. It's Santa Rosa plum with an outward arching growth habit, and it is actually one of the most spectacular landscape fruit trees you can plant. It looks kind of, I won't say it looks like a weeping willow, but it has that strongly decurrent growth habit, and it makes a real focal point. So if you're choosing places for your different fruit trees, and you've got a place that's going to be like right out of the view of the window, it's an excellent choice for that. That weeping habit seems to enhance yield. Not sure we need that with a Santa Rosa plum, but it does. You get a lot more fruit. It seems to get, I mean, just crowded with fruit. And it takes a little training and thinning to really develop the structure of it beautifully. This has been done nicely on this one, as far as I can see. So it's a really good one to look for. It's not real common in the nursery trade, but it really is a lovely ornamental fruiting tree to add to your landscape, even if you just have room for a single tree that's going to be out part of the landscape, part of the garden. Weeping Santa Rosa is a great choice. It does take a little, as I say, training and thinning to get the structure enhanced.
The next question is, well, it's related to my yard. Now, those who have listened for a long time may know that I am struggling with trying to get all the passion flower vines out. I have been struggling for...
Did I sell you these passion flower vines, or did you get them from someone else?
Probably. I don't know. I don't know where they came from. But I had one, and I thought, oh, that's pretty. I'll just leave it because the flowers are beautiful. I left it. I had the butterflies that come along with it. Oh, they're beautiful. And then I realized that they also seed incredibly and everywhere. And they're not just garden thugs, Don. They're invasive alien creatures.
Okay. Yeah, we need to back up here. Passion flowers and passion fruit are in the genus Passiflora.
And there's lots of them. And this one is one.
There's a Passiflora Society, which I looked at one point. And on their database, they had 4,000 species and cultivars of Passiflora. Wow. The overwhelming majority of them are tropical plants that don't overwinter here at all. Most of them are too tender to grow in the valley. The fruiting ones are just hardy enough to grow here in the valley, by which I mean specifically Passiflora edulis. When you see,
and these are the fruiting ones that you can eat the fruit of?
Yes. When you see EDULIS as a species name, edulis just means eaten. It's the one you eat. So Passiflora edulis is the well-known passion fruit that it's one of them. And most of the ones that you would grow or buy are in that species. There are other species that make edible fruit. You need to learn a lot about them if you're planning to grow passion fruit for the fruit, because some of them you have to wait until it literally is kind of like rotting on the vine. Some of them are not edible at all until they're just way beyond what most people would think they should look like to eat. Others are great. They are a little tender here. I would never expect someone growing any variety of Passiflora edulis to have any problem with them reseeding or suckering because they freeze back. They're marginal in this area, in Sunset Zone 9, as we are, USDA Zone, Sunset Zone 14, USDA zone 9, they freeze back hard. And so they come back and they can grow here, but we tell people, be aware this one will probably freeze back and you'll have to cut it back and so forth. There are ornamental passifloras that are highly, 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 I won't say invasive because they aren't truly invasive here, but they're definitely garden thugs, as the British like to say. And some that are in between. There's a lot of passifloras that are perfectly fine to have in your garden that aren't going to take over, except most of them do sucker from the roots to some degree. And probably the one you have more likely suckering than reseeding, but it could be doing both. Who knows? Suckering is the biggest problem for a lot of people with them. They are the fascinating flowers, beautiful. There is a butterfly, the Gulf fritillary, non-native butterfly. It's not native here. We have Western fritillaries in California, but the Gulf fritillary, as the name suggests, is from the Gulf. And
Gulf of Mexico.
Yes. And we have a well-established population of the Gulf fritillary butterflies because we have so many gardeners growing passiflora. So you're contributing probably to that population of the butterfly. It's interesting. It is very specific as to which ones it oviposits on and which ones it doesn't. So we have a passiflora going all down the fence around our parking lot at the nursery. We see the Gulf fritillaries come in. They're attracted to the flowers. We watch them go towards the leaf and then back off. They don't oviposit on the particular one that we have. But there are people who have planted certain species where they get clouds of these butterflies because they're ovipositing.
And then those red caterpillars.
They are. They're very attractive and interesting caterpillars, and they completely defoliate the vines. So that's an issue. You're going to have a vine that basically looks like it's being eaten, but you'll have dozens of these beautiful, interesting fritillary butterflies on them. So that's a reason, one of the reasons people like to grow them. The other is that the flowers are fascinating. And the Xylocopa carpenter bees are very attracted to them. So they're a cool thing to have. But when you're looking at them, if you're in the interior, look up one, how cold hardy it is, the one you're thinking of buying or thinking of ordering. Two, how vigorous it is and whether it's going to be kept in check, as I put on description on my website on some of them, kept in check by cold. So some are not. There's one that's hardy enough to grow up into Oregon, the Maypop, which is root hardy and has grown even into much colder USDA zones and sunset zones than here. That just dies down to the ground, comes back up, spreads like crazy until it's kind of a nightmare, but it's used medicinally. So that is often planted by people. So they range from totally tender, a fair number that are acceptably hardy for our area, one or two that are even more cold hardy than here. All of them vigorous vines, typically. The only question is what happens to them each winter. Passifloras are sold as evergreen vines, and they typically are. But if we get to 32 degrees, some of them will be essentially defoliated, although the stems will remain. If we get below 32 degrees, many of them, the stems themselves will be killed back. So further down on the plant, they'll resprout. That's the typical pattern with the edible form, by the way. Partial top kill, resprouting from somewhere further down. They typically regrow very vigorously as soon as it gets to the temperature range that they like, which is subtropical temperatures. You know, for getting into the 70s, 80s, they're going to be thrilled. 90s are fine. They don't mind at 100 degrees. That is absolutely great for a passiflora vine. But the injury varies from year to year, and it varies from species to species. There's some that never defoliate. They're perfectly hardy here. There's others that you can barely grow them, but they're worth it for the amazing, bizarre flowers that they have. The flower of a passion flower is really interesting and attracts people. The fruit, that's one of the marginal types. So you've got to be aware that wherever you put it, it's going to look rough in the winter. Even this year, when we didn't get, you know, get freezing cold enough to cause the injury, they're very yellow, very anemic looking because of cold injury, not freezing injury, I guess is the best way to put it. Some of the top will probably end up getting cut back and it'll just resprout as soon as we get into roughly tomato planting season. It'll be back in no time. If you're in Southern California or the coastal areas, there are some passifloras that can take over your whole yard and your whole neighborhood just from the plant, not from reseeding, just the plant spreading vigorously. The red flowered one, coccinia, which was very popular in Southern California when I was working in a nursery down there. I remember an alley in La Jolla that was completely covered with it. I mean, it had been planted in one yard and it had engulfed all of the yards because you never get frost there. So be very careful which ones you choose in frost free areas and be reasonably careful which ones you choose in frosty areas. Container might be a great way to go for a lot of people.
So you keep saying this year we didn't get freezing, but we got cold and did this and that. Does that mean that we're at the end of January now? Does that mean that we're over the hazardous times or?
January 22nd, 2025, we got to 23 degrees on our farm.
All right. We'll still not,
Hey,
we'll not call it spring
I
until
was looking through
about
old
the 80s.
pictures. I always take pictures of the first frost and the last frost if I possibly can. First frost is easy. Last frost, I have to try to remember.
You have to take a picture of every frost.
Right, so January 22nd, 2025, 23 degrees on our farm. Did significant injury to some of my young mandarins, actually. In town, most people got to about 29, 30 degrees, which is still cold enough to injure many of the plants we were just talking about. Winters got to 25, 26 degrees. It was just one night. It was for about 6 hours, one night. So the duration was not extensive, but it did a fair bit of damage. The last typical frost here, of what I've learned over the years, a reasonable range is Thanksgiving to Valentine's Day, is when you have a pretty high likelihood of having a frost and injury from that frost. I have pictures of frost in March. I even have a picture of a frost in the first week of April. That was memorable. But typically, it's about Thanksgiving to Valentine's Day here. So.
Okay, well, let's go on to the next question. And this is from James. Oh, wise one, he writes. I'm having difficulty getting cilantro coriander to germinate and grow in my garden. A few years ago, I had large quantities of cilantro, but now I have Italian parsley popping up everywhere and only a few sparse cilantro plants in the winter. When I plant and irrigate fresh coriander seeds in summer, I get hardly any germination or growth. I'm in sunset zone 16, so typically with the highs in the upper 70s and 80s in the summer. Shouldn't it be possible for me to stagger plantings and have cilantro year round? If so, what am I likely to be missing? What do I need to do? Thank you for your excellent show.
Cilantro is in the same family as parsley and dill and all those other things. And members of that family are well known for having an inhibitor in the seed coat that prevents germination until it's been rinsed or soaked or whatever to get the inhibitor out of the seed coat. And so, standard recommendation with parsley, for example, is soak the seed overnight or for at least a few hours before you plant it. Otherwise, it'll take 5 or 6 weeks to germinate. Then it only takes, a couple of weeks to germinate. Cilantro, same thing. Soaking the seed can be helpful. Old seed, aged seed, would probably just get harder and drier. And you do have the interesting structural phenomenon. If you look at a cilantro seed, it's actually two seeds that are surrounded by a fairly firm seed
Husk.
coat, the husk, sure. And if you dry that too much, like the seed has gotten old, you'll get poor germination unless you pre-soak it. You may still get poor germination. So the first would be to pre-soak the seed. Almost all seed of everything that I can think of germinates best at about 55 to 85 degrees. Some plants are fine at even higher temperatures. Even though cilantro is a cool season preferring plant, those are good temperatures for germination. I think you've been doing that, so I don't think that's an issue. You mentioned fresh seed, and I'm curious what that means. So if you were saving seed from your plant, it's quite possible you harvested prematurely and it just wasn't really ready and therefore it wasn't viable. You might want to buy fresh seed from a seed rack that's dated for this current year. Important to know, all seed packets are dated. We change out our seed packet rack every season, and we've just put up all the 2026 seed. The 2025 seed goes away. Either the seed company takes it back if they're on guaranteed sale, or we donate them to schools, which is what we do with ours, those teachers and so forth. Last year's seed is still okay, but as each year goes by, you do get a declining percentage of germination. So it might be that your seed was old. It might be that your seed was too young. I didn't ever think cilantro was problematic in this regard, but that harder seed coat can be an issue. So pre-soaking the seed would be one thing I would do. I would also probably try some in pots rather than putting them in the ground because it's entirely possible that your seedlings are coming up and disappearing before you even noticed it because there's lots of things like white-crowned sparrows and stuff that like to eat seedlings. So it's possible that you were just losing them as they were germinating. More likely, it's an issue with the seed. Too old, too young, too dry. One of those things in there. That inhibitor in the seed coat can be an issue with parsley, fennel, anise, cilantro, anything in that group. Carrots, celery, all of them. What I would do is take them and put them in a bowl, bring water to a boil, pour the water on the seeds in the bowl, let it at least come to room temperature. Better yet, let it sit overnight, then take the seed out and plant it, because that tends to soften the seed coat enough and hopefully get the inhibitor out of the seed coat that you'll get better germination.
Two questions. Is the inhibitor built in by the plant, or is it something that's sprayed on when
Oh, it's
people pack up
natural.
the seeds? It's
No,
natural.
it's
Okay.
natural in the plant. Yeah.
And then the second question is, when can you plant cilantro? Because he's talking about he'd like to stagger plantings to have
Well,
cilantro all the time.
he's in zone 16, which puts him a little closer to the coast. If you know your Sunset Western Garden Book zones, 15, 16, 17 are the coast of Northern California. 17 is Berkeley. The old joke was 17 is the flats of Berkeley, 16 is the hill above Berkeley. The difference was explained to me many years ago. In zone 17, your bougainvillea will grow lush but won't bloom. In zone 16, it will get enough sun to bloom. So you're just getting higher up in the Bay Area. You should be able to grow cilantro pretty much year round, although midsummer, it'll probably do for you what it does for us, which is it'll just bolt right away. Listeners in the Central Valley who like cilantro, which does not include me, listeners in the Central Valley who like cilantro have learned that we can plant it here in two fairly narrow windows, October to early November, and you'll harvest into the winter. And if we don't get real cold, it'll go through the winter. This year, for example, it probably did. If we get, even normal frost, it'll be damaged. And so you'll have to harvest quickly before that happens. And then again, in February is another good time to plant cilantro for harvest, basically in March and April. Anytime we start getting above 70 or 80 degrees, 80 degrees especially, it just bolts, it just flowers and goes to seed. Also, the plants you buy in garden centers, hate to say this, are usually kind of stressed. They're very root bound. There's usually way more seedlings in there than you need. And so they just flower right away, probably because of that stress. And so it's one of the more unsatisfactory things that we sell here in the valley. People don't get good results. That same plant in Berkeley, Fort Bragg, Monterey would do fine. It's just that here, the combination of root binding and stress and higher temperatures just cause it to flower and go to seed. The seed, by the way, is usable. It's coriander. The seed of cilantro is just coriander, so you can use it that way. And the flowers are usable. They taste just like the leaves. So if your plant is about to go to bloom, don't hesitate to harvest it and use it. It'll taste just fine if you like cilantro, but it'll be a very short season. So I get people who come in buying cilantro and they come back a few weeks later and they're frustrated because it just flowered. That's what it does here. Coastal zones, you should be able to plant every few weeks, but I would pre-soak the seed.
So Don sometimes sends me questions that have come up to him in his nursery. And so I'm going to read a few of these. Most of these are January questions, and it was just a typical day in the nursery.
This is
So
a typical weekend of questions. The first couple that came in struck me as being unusual, so I started jotting them down as I sometimes do. And so this is what you need to know if you want to go work at a garden center.
oh, you gave me the hard one first.
Yes.
Identifying and discussing our malaria fungus versus Phytophthora crown rot on a rose.
Yeah, a rose bush that was killed by what appeared to be disease. And it was a Cecil Bruner rose, so there's a vigorous plant to
Did
begin
they
with.
bring you the rose?
No, they did not. And that would be helpful in this case because what they saw was yellow mushrooms at the base. Okay, now if you look up yellow mushrooms in the soil, it's pretty high likelihood that some site is going to show you a picture of our malaria root rot, oak root fungus, which we do have, although I've honestly been doing this for a while. I have not seen it personally in Davis, but I do remember cases in Winters, more oak trees there, I guess, than here. The problem is that a whole lot of mushrooms look alike. And unless you're a trained mycologist, just seeing yellow mushrooms on the ground doesn't tell you that you necessarily have our malaria or even another pathogenic fungus. Most of the mushrooms you see are harmless. Most of the mushrooms you see are just the fruiting bodies of otherwise harmless fungus organisms. I think his plant died from crown rot, from what he was describing to me. And then because it's died and the roots are decaying and the trunk is decaying, he's getting fungus growing on them. So he's blaming the fungus for doing its job. The fungus is in there decaying the dead wood, the dead roots. I don't think the fungus that he saw, the mushrooms that he saw, which looked like typical Basidium, Basidiomycetes, didn't look like our malaria to me. He was concerned about did he need to treat the soil? Well, there wouldn't be any treatment anyway. You just look for plants that are resistant if you happen to actually have our malaria. But I think that he was doing something that we see very commonly, blaming the fungus for the death of the plant. The thing that probably killed the plant most likely was Phytophthora, which is no longer considered a fungus. It's a water mold, but they're in their own whole different kingdom, practically. One of the most common causes of plant death in the valley, and we call it crown rot or root rot. And when the nursery says to you, you overwatered, what they're really saying, as we've mentioned many times on the show, they're really saying you created conditions favorable for infection by Phytophthora. That doesn't
you water too frequently.
Well,
you left it too wet. You piled stuff up around the trunk.
Yes.
You did something so that there was standing water and a warm temperature, and it died.
And not necessarily standing water that you were seeing, not necessarily right. visible water on the surface. The Phytophthora spores, which are motile, means they swim, which is one of the reasons they took it out of the plant kingdom. We don't have any swimming spores in plants. it needs a surface of moisture on the soil particles, in order to swim over and start attacking under the bark of the woody plant. The bark of the woody plant has been buried by soil or leaf debris, but most commonly soil. That's the biggest issue, trapping moisture there, giving that little motile spore perfect conditions to spend some time digging in and infecting. And multiple spores are doing this. A few, you would probably never notice a difference, but if you create the conditions, high moisture, high temperature. Those are the two conditions for Phytophthora. High moisture, high temperature, 90% humidity, 90 degree temperature. We usually see crown rot, root rot problems after a heat wave because people water too often during a heat wave. And they very commonly have a drip system right next to the plant that's trickling a little water right at the base. So they're making perfect conditions for Phytophthora.
If you make it, they will come.
They're already there. That's right. The comment about Phytophthora when I took plant pathology that I'll never forget was, someone said, how do you know where it is? And the professor just said, assume it's there.
Yeah.
It's not native here. The Phytophthora, they don't actually really know exactly where it came from. Phytophthora cinnamomei, easily spread in soil on boots, tractors, horses, cars, whatever. So if you're in an agricultural community, it's present. So if you've made the conditions favorable for it, it will attack. So this is a case where the disease triangle tells us change the environment, that is, rather than focusing on the pathogen, rather than focusing necessarily on the host, change the environment to reduce the likelihood of infection.
And it's easy. It's easy to have roses that don't get root rot. You simply make sure that they're not planted too deep, haven't buried them, and you're not constantly spraying them every day.
I mean, roses love water. Roses love water. They like to be watered, and they're generally planted in soil that people have amended for better or worse. So the water tends to drain away from the crown. That right there is not a huge issue. It's the constant trickle right next to the plant and mulching around it. Now, we know, we used to tell people all the time, don't put mulch around the bark of plants. Dr. Chalker Scott up in Washington State has done a lot of work on mulches. She's big on arborist wood chips, for example. To summarize her comments over many years, the chunkier the mulch, the less of a problem you're going to have. There's big air spaces. It's too big for that little motile spore to jump. They have to swim. They can't jump through the air. So big chunks of bark or any kind of bark or even compost, which is coarse, relatively speaking, by a soil standard, you're not going to usually have any problem with Phytophthora there. It's when you bring soil in around it. And this comes up with roses as one example. In our area, we plant roses with their graft union, if they're grafted up and out of the ground. We put it a couple inches up. I had a problem with some David Austin roses, and I contacted the company. Some of them, I just contacted them for replacement, and I showed them a picture, and they replied, oh, you need to bury the graft union a couple inches. And I thought, that's weird. We don't do that in California. So there are places, I'm told, where they bury the graft union for cold protection, because tea roses, hybrid tea roses, are too tender to grow in some climates. So you bury the graft, you mulch over them, that keeps it alive. We don't do that here. We don't bury the graft union of a rose ever. And the reason we don't is because we're concerned that that will encourage the likelihood of Phytophthora. So use your recommendations from your rose supplier carefully. Make sure they're regionally appropriate. In this particular case, I'm pretty sure that he had a crown rot situation. That's the most likely thing I could think of, other than gophers, which you'd probably have some evidence if they were present. And the fungus that you're seeing, the mushrooms that you're seeing, are almost surely not the problem. That doesn't mean our malaria doesn't exist. People do have it. It occurs around here. But I think that when you go to the fruiting body of a fungus and assume that was what caused the problem, you should look back in the history of the plant. If it was dying in the late summer and fall and you're seeing the mushrooms in the winter, pretty high likelihood that it was something else that killed it in the late summer and fall.
Think of mushrooms as the cleanup team.
That's right. They're good.
They're the carrion eaters of the plant world.
They're generally not harmful. There are some fungus that you should be concerned about, but when you just try to resolve a problem by taking a picture and looking at an app, you might be sent in the wrong direction. Let's put it that way.
Well, this question came into the nursery about managing raspberry horntail borers on rosers with winter pruning. Are there treatments for raspberry horntail borers?
Yeah, she was actually looking for a dormant spray. Dormant sprays are used on roses for fungus problems. I don't think they make that much difference, but there's nothing wrong with it. Part of the step process of pruning roses that you're likely to get from a rose society includes, after you've cut them back and stripped all the leaves off, take a conventional dormant spray such as copper and oil and spray. And she was wondering if that would help with the raspberry horntail borer. That's the bug that gets in when the big flush of growth is coming on in the spring and they're just forming the flower buds, and you go out and one or two of them have wilted over like a shepherd's hook and the rest of them are fine. So you know it's not a watering problem because just that one branch or two branches out of 10 that are doing it. That's the raspberry horntail borer adult has come along, ovipositive in the stem. The little baby gets out and starts working its way down the cambium, which is the water conducting tissue of the plant, as well as the food conducting tissue of the plant. The water coming up, all of a sudden it completes a circuit, makes it all the way around, and it blocks the movement of water up to the top, and it wilts very dramatically. So it's very visible. And sometimes people have a lot of them and they're really frustrating because this is that first flush of bloom you've been counting on, and you get, several of them on one plant. That's a little disappointing. You just prune it out. You find that spot on the stem. It's very visible. You can even, for fun, peel back the bark and find the little horntail borer in there. They're visible. They're present. They've usually made it down about 3 to 4 inches before they girdle what's above there. So go down beyond that point and cut. Take a look at the cut end of what you just cut off. If there's a dot in the cambium, you need to go further. That's all you do. There is no treatment for raspberry horntail borer and nothing that we'll do in the winter. If you're pruning and you find hollow stems, there are twig nesting borers that can move into roses, and they don't directly harm the plant in the sense that the horntail borer does. These are different, but they can trap moisture in there. And so it's not uncommon to find a situation where the twig nesting borers have gotten in and there's moisture in there. And so that part of the cane dies back. Prune all that out. Be aware of that. That's pretty much all you do. I do remember a rose pruning seminar I went to in Sacramento by Sacramento's premier rosarian, Muriel Humanick, who went through all these step-by-step process and said at the beginning, this is the classic method of pruning roses. This is what we do when we're growing them for competition, for rose shows, that kind of thing. And at the end of it, she said, now, this may sound funny, but you take Elmer's glue, okay, and you daub some Elmer's glue on each cut end. And she sort of looked at it less like, yeah, I know, you're all nursery people. You're laughing at this. She's, I never really thought it made any difference either. But where she was over in El Dorado County, she said a lot of rosarians up there would find these twig nesting borers could become a real nuisance, and that this seemed to prevent them. And as she put it, and it also seems to be harmless. So for what it's worth, the leading rosarian in Sacramento used to recommend daubing Elmer's glue on the cut end of your roses as one of the last steps in the process, not for the horntail borer, but for the twig nesting borers. And she said it seemed to work. I throw that out there anecdotally. I've never done it myself, but on the plus side, Elmer's glue comes in a very convenient applicator. You can just blob it right on there and it doesn't appear to hurt the plant at all. Twig nesting borers, again, are not harmful directly, but they can cause cane dieback. More to the point, if you're pruning and you see any dieback in a cane, keep pruning until you've got it all out of there. That's really one of the main purposes of pruning roses, to get out the diseased or infested wood. And this is one situation where you can do that with a little harder pruning.
And a customer came in who said they had an Owari Satsuma and they wanted a good mandarin variety to complement it.
Yeah, Owari Satsuma is the very popular, easy to peel mandarin that we start harvesting in November. December is really the main season of harvest. In January, they're pretty much done. So looking for a mandarin that ripens later. And you have a number of them. Most of them ripen later. But I would say two in particular have become very popular. Tango, which is part of the Cuties program. So if you've bought Cuties, you've probably eaten Tango. As mid-season to late, you can harvest them as early as February. March, they're really at their peak. April, they're still very good. And they hang on the tree pretty well and really good. Just one that's just blowing everybody away for flavor. And how long they hang on the tree is Gold Nugget. Gold Nugget Mandarin starts ripening, according to textbook, in April, but I have people picking them in January and enjoying them. They're still a little high acidity, but the sugar content is there. So they hang on the tree all the way March, April, May. And I am told, I hope this is true because I've planted a dozen of these, hold very well on the tree all the way into the summer. So you're picking very good mandarins off a tree in July or even August. So if you want to complement any of the earlier ripening mandarins, Gold Nugget is a great addition to your garden. And the plant, in 10 years, it'll be 8 to 10 feet tall. And this is without pruning, 7 to 8 feet across, very oval shape, at least so far. Mine have shown that habit. Not as much work as Tango, which needs more pruning because of how vigorous it is. Clementine, Gold Nugget are very attractive landscape trees, as well as being really easy to grow and stretching your season out beautifully that way.
All right. Here's the question for you. The question of the day, Don. What's the sweetest mandarin?
That's a complex answer.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
What's the sweetest? Not the tastiest, but the highest sugar content.
Well, the people who are selling the sumo mandarins want you to believe that theirs are. So there's a reason for that. They pick them, and it's about the same sugar content as a Satsuma mandarin or a clementine or the others, all of which have roughly the same sugar content when they're they're ripe. But they then have this process where they hold them for about 3 weeks before they ship them to market. And in doing that, they have measured the sugar content, or at least the soluble solids content, which is mostly sugar, goes up 1 or 2 degrees Brix, which is how you measure those things. So they're saying, now look, your Satsuma is 11, your Sumo is 13, so it's sweeter. But that isn't how you perceive sweetness, okay? We don't perceive sweetness based on just the sugar content. The acidity is a big factor. So low acidity with normal sugar content will taste sweeter to most people. One of the sweetest fruit in terms of sugar content is a pineapple. Would most of you say pineapples are very sweet? Probably not, because they're very high acidity. So they're a combination of acid plus very high sugar. They got very rich flavor. But most people wouldn't say, pineapple, yeah, that's the sweetest fruit. The sugar content alone is not what counts. It's the sugar content balanced by the high or low acidity. And you need some acidity to give the flavor a little more kick. I would say that the lower acidity of the clementines will make people think they're sweeter. Clementines are the first of the three that are in the Cuties program that you might be familiar with from the grocery store. They peel easily. They're very sweet. They've got a great texture, and their acidity is relatively low. They're actually considered to be a cross between an orange and a mandarin. So they have more of the orange characteristic, which is lower acidity than a mandarin. So many people would say the clementines are sweeter. But if you could save a clementine and a Satsuma and a Tango and a Gold Nugget all side by side, I suspect you would consider the flavor of the Gold Nugget to be better, even though the sugar content is the same. So.
But the question was the sweetest mandarin, and we're going with Clement.
There you go.
Or Cuties. Yeah.
Yeah. Cuties is a program, so we've got to say that. There's three different varieties in the Cuties program: Clementine, Tango, and Murcott. And they do differ slightly in terms of their flavor profile.
I'm looking for a 15-15-15 fertilizer and some bone meal. Now, I don't know where they're getting these recommendations.
Oh,
probably online somewhere.
50, 60 years ago, fertilizer manufacturers realized that people would buy a fertilizer if it had even numbers, by which I mean all the same number, NPK, than if it was weird to them. So, for example, 15, 15, 15 is 15% nitrogen, 15% phosphorus, 15% potassium.
That's huge.
Well, it's very common. Another one, common one, is 5, 10, 10. You'll see that. I used to see that recommended in cooperative extension publications for vegetables. 5, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 5, 5, 5. None of that has any relationship to how plants use nutrients. There are no plants I know of that use nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium in equal amounts. Studies that have been done on this on residue studies where they take, for example, measure the nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium in citrus that's being harvested in the fruit, have found in that particular case, it's about a 3-1-2 ratio, not a 1-1-1 ratio.
So, or 3-3-3.
Yeah. So some citrus fertilizer manufacturers, including the one we work with, has roughly 3-1-2 ratio of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. That doesn't tell you what's in the soil. So if you really want to figure out what your soil needs, and this is for people listening anywhere, at some point, you should probably have a soil test done. It's pretty easy to do. You can go online, you can find companies that will do it, and they follow the directions carefully for how to take the soil sample and send it in. I have looked at many, many, many soil tests in this area, and they're all pretty much the same in our region. Nobody needs phosphorus. I've never seen a soil test here that was showed a deficiency in phosphorus. Usually what it shows, that's the middle number, usually what it shows is as high up on the bar as their software will go in terms of portraying it. In other words, it is as much as they could record, and usually it's excessive, if anything. So we certainly don't need to be adding phosphorus, but there's a widespread belief, as you all know, that phosphorus stimulates bloom, increases fruit production. No, it doesn't do any of those things. It's just one of those necessary plant nutrients. In our area, it's not deficient. I used to just tell myself, okay, this doesn't really matter. It's one of those that is it necessary? Is it harmful? Is it necessary? No, adding phosphorus is almost never necessary here. Is it harmful? Well, I didn't think it was, but we do realize that adding large amounts of phosphorus, especially incorporating it into the root zone, because phosphorus is really hard to get into the plant. If you just throw it on the surface, it really doesn't do much of anything. But if you incorporate it into the root zone and you do a lot of it, as is often recommended, it actually suppresses the growth of rather important soil mycorrhizae, which live on or in the roots of the plant and greatly increase the plant's ability to take up not just water, but nutrients. So if you add too much phosphorus, you're suppressing the plant's natural ability to take up nutrients. So you could be causing some of these micronutrient deficiencies that we see commonly in our area. Iron, zinc, manganese deficiencies may well be tied to excess use of phosphorus. So it could be harmful. Not usually really harmful. It's one of those things where I just kind of bit my tongue in the past. At this point, I prefer personally not to stock numbered fertilizer bags that are simply numbered that way for marketing. I'd rather have you buying what you actually need, which is primarily just nitrogen. We're rarely deficient in potassium. I've never actually seen a potassium deficiency either. So the main thing you need is nitrogen, the first number. The other numbers, phosphorus, in my opinion, should be pretty low. You probably don't need it. And potassium doesn't really matter one way or another.
Now, is phosphorus something that when it runs off and gets into the water system is not good for, I mean, we're talking plants, but what about the rest of the things?
Yeah, when phosphorus is readily adsorbed, which is a term that refers to the ability of the soil, either the clay particles or the organic particles to glom onto, there's a technical term, hold on to, ionically attach themselves to the phosphorus ion. And it stays there and it does not easily get to the root zone. So this is the first thing. Throwing it on the surface, you've now made a nice layer of phosphorus that the plant will never probably take up. So you have to incorporate it if you have a deficiency in phosphorus in the first place. You just throw it on the surface, it doesn't go anywhere unless the soil runs off. So if you have enough rainfall or enough irrigation to carry soil down into the storm drain system, you're carrying phosphates into the storm drain system. And indeed, phosphates are pollution. Also, producing phosphorus fertilizer causes a lot of pollution where it comes from in Florida and other places. So there are environmental consequences of using high doses of phosphorus. And in our area, there's very little runoff because we have very little slope. But in places where you actually get water running off the surface, carrying soil or mulch, because mulch can tie up the phosphates as well, into the storm drain system, it's going off into wherever your storm water goes. So it's undesirable. So there is that harmful aspect of it as well. Most people aren't using that much, so it's not that big a deal. But I'd like to get away from the notion that plants need even numbers of fertilizer components and that plants need phosphorus in general. A phosphorus deficiency indicated by a soil test, go ahead and apply it at the rate recommended. If your soil test does not indicate a deficiency, there actually can be some harm from excess phosphorus application.
What does bone meal do?
That's just phosphorus. So well, there's
no
need
for
bone meal
is straight phosphorus.
Yes, bone meal is basically all phosphorus. So there's, I don't think we have any need or use for bone meal in this area whatsoever. It's a very slow acting source of phosphorus. It takes months, if not years, to fully release. But someone who is looking for a 15-15-15 fertilizer, the bone meal would be redundant. because you've already got more phosphorus than you need in the balanced. They call those balanced fertilizers. That's a misnomer. They're called balanced fertilizers because the numbers are the same, not because there's some part of a balanced nutrition need of the plant.
One customer came in and said they had grapefruits, but they had brown discoloration on the peel. It wasn't penetrating the flesh or causing the fruit damage, except some had dried out. And some of the fruit is bitter.
Yeah, so this was good that he brought a sample, because if I had just heard, oh, brown on the peel, I would have thought citrus brown rot or citrus blast, which are both diseases that we occasionally see here. Good example to bring in the fruit, because I could tell all the damage was just on the external part of the peel. It was just like burnished is what it looked like. In general, that damage doesn't go any further into the fruit, has been my experience, but it can as they start to ripen. If there's been any injury in the waxy coating of the fruit, like hailstorm or bruised as they're blowing around in the wind, you can get a point of entry. And that area with the brown discoloration seems likelier to do that. So you can get rot going. And he said, yeah, some of them were spoiled, but most of them weren't. It was interesting that I took a knife and cut into it, and I was able to see the juice sacs, which is the little membranous part of each segment of the citrus that bursts out juice when you bite into it, were kind of separated and kind of tough looking. And that is an indication that there was drought stress at an important time in the development of that fruit. What he was seeing here, in my opinion, was likely to be sunburn on the fruit, burnishing the peel due to less of a waxy layer protecting it, due to lack of irrigation at an important period of development, probably late summer.
So asked about the watering, this person said they were using a drip system
Yep.
with 1 to 2 emitters per tree,
on the tree,
running a few minutes each day. Oh, my.
Yeah, so the tree was basically not getting water. I mean, that's what it comes down to. When you've got 1 or 2 emitters, even if they're the highest output at 2 gallons an hour, you know, 4 gallons an hour, running for a few minutes is less than a gallon, certainly, probably less than a half a gallon every day, which is not optimal. Everything about that is wrong. So my suggestion there was that this tree needs its own drip ring. I mean, if you're gonna change your drip system, it needs a bunch of emitters. Going in 2 rings would be even better. One fairly close into the trunk and one out on the drip line of the tree. This is an established tree. So my guess is that what happened here was the irrigation system was changed over to drip. We go through this every summer. They only put a couple emitters on this one tree. So a little trickle of water is getting to the tree every day. That's nowhere near enough. That if it's too complicated to change your drip system for this tree, just take a hose once every 3 to 4 weeks. A couple weeks would be great, but every 3 to 4 weeks at a bare minimum, send it out there at a moderate flow. Make sure there's a basin where the water will collect around the tree and then soak in. You want to water that tree to a depth of at least 18 inches, and you're never going to do that with that kind of drip system. You'd have to put in way more emitters and run it way longer, which is fine if you want to embark on that project this year. But until then, deep soakings, at least once a month, a couple times a month would be great. 15 to 20 gallons all at once would be ideal. More would probably be fine. If you want to go with drip, it needs to be distributed evenly over the whole root zone, which, as we know, goes past the drip line of the tree. So you have to have not just, you know, on the edge of the tree, but even further out, and has to run for a very long time. Sunburn on citrus can be mitigated with sprays like the kale and clay type materials to act as a sunburn preventative. But you know what really prevents sunburn on citrus is the waxy coating of the fruit naturally has, if it's growing well, reduces sunburn injury. So deep watering, no drought stress, especially in those critical times of about July, August, early September, when the fruit is in the expansion phase, that seems to make the most difference.
And we will close with this garden quote: pray for a good harvest, but continue to hoe.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.